Hello, I'm Robin Williams, and welcome to the 2014 Boyer Lectures. For over half a century, the ABC's premier lecture series has featured prominent Australians from all walks of life. And last year we heard from Quinton Bryce, the then Governor General, the first woman to occupy that role. And now another first. Professor Suzanne Corey is a former president of the Australian Academy of Science and is the first woman to be elected to that position. A medical researcher for nearly 45 years, Professor Suzanne Corey and her colleagues contributed to the watershed realisation that some of our genes are time bombs that may lead to cancer. This has had a major impact, not only on our understanding of how cancer develops, but also on how to treat it. In these lectures, Professor Corey, former director of the renowned Walter and Eliza Hall Institute in Melbourne, talks personally about her work. And in coming weeks, we shall also hear how much our economy depends on science and technology, how we must be far more thoughtful about our environment, and finally, the role of women in this modern world, or what that role should be. Professor Suzanne Corey's first lecture is called Science for a Healthy People.
I'd like to begin by challenging you all. Try to count the number of times that you might have died if it were not for medical science. Have you ever had an ear infection? I had so many when I was a baby, and I woke up in terrible pain. I can still remember those visits to the doctors. Without antibiotics, I could have developed a deadly brain infection. Have you had polio, tetanus, or measles vaccines? Without immunization, any of these diseases could have killed you. Are you in remission after a successful course of cancer treatment? Are you still counting? I think you'd have to agree with me that we're extremely fortunate to be living in a time of unprecedented healthcare. In ancient Egypt, Babylon, and Greece, the average life expectancy was around 30. And this did not change in Europe for a further 25 centuries. Today, Australian boys can expect to live until they're almost 80, and girls until they're 84. This dramatic change is thanks to medical science. How much further can it go? Can we expect or afford continued improvement? Today, I want to very briefly consider where medical science has come from and where it's heading, drawing out implications not only for health, but also for the economy. Although the first medical school began in Europe in the 9th century, in Italy, Western medicine remained primitive, and treatments were largely limited to untested herbal remedies, some of those around still, bloodletting, prayer, and brutal surgery without anaesthetics. Major improvement only started in the late 19th century when science started moving into medicine, most notably after Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch proved their germ theory of disease. Knowing that germs caused sickness led to the introduction of antiseptics and public health measures, and to vital education about simple hygiene. Many, many lives were saved, especially of women in childbirth, through simply requiring doctors and nurses to wash their hands before and after touching a patient. Then came the first vaccines, against smallpox by Edward Jenner and against rabies and anthrax by Louis Pasteur. But even with these advances, life was still precarious for children in the early 20th century. Tiny graves in Australian churchyards bear silent witness to the cruel scything by diphtheria, whooping cough, typhoid, and scarlet fever. When the polio epidemic hit our primary schools in the 50s, my brother's friend died, and the girl who sat next to my sister in class was paralysed. During the Second World War, not so long ago really, the toll of infections on soldiers was horrific, and Australian Howard Florey set out to turn the tide, together with his Oxford colleague Ernst Chain. Some years before, Alexander Fleming had noticed that a mould contaminating his petri dish had killed the Staphylococcus bacteria growing there. In 1941, Florian Chain succeeded in isolating the active antibacterial agent, which was then mass-produced in the US and shipped to the troops. Ever since, penicillin has been one of our mainstays for treating infections. In today's world, antibiotics and extensive public immunization programs have totally transformed community health. Smallpox has even been eradicated from the world, and hopefully polio will soon be too. Although shamefully, children in developing countries are still dying of diseases that we know how to avoid. The 21st century has ushered in a new era of medicine, driven by two intersecting scientific tidal waves, genetics and IT. You're all aware of the digital revolution. Babies play with iPhones. However, the impact of the DNA revolution is perhaps not so widely known nor appreciated. DNA is the molecule of life. It's like your hard disk, buried deep in the heart of every cell in your body. It contains all the instructions needed for a single fertilized egg to develop into the 50 trillion or so cells of a fully functional adult. Think of that. It's amazing. The story of DNA is fascinating. It's the story of our times, and it's also why I became a molecular biologist. I still clearly remember that moment at Melbourne University in the 60s, when my first year genetics lecturer rushed in to tell us, hot off the scientific press, that our chromosomes each contain a single gigantic molecule of DNA. Nobody had ever conceived that such a huge molecule could ever exist. And his excitement that day was so infectious that it started my lifelong love affair with DNA. The DNA revolution had begun in 1953, when two brash young scientists, Jim Watson and Francis Crick, raced some of the most eminent scientists in the world and beat them at their game. They deduced the structure of DNA, the elegant double helix that's been called the Mona Lisa of modern science. When Watson and Crick saw the structure, they realized they had the secret to life, and they raced off to celebrate at their local Cambridge pub, the Eagle. What they had seen was that if you peeled the two DNA strands away from each other and copied each of them, you'd end up with two identical double helices. It became obvious how genetic information could be passed from one cell to the next, from one generation to the next. Actually, this momentous discovery depended on the painstaking work of many other scientists, geneticists, physicists, and chemists. But Watson and Crick grabbed the clues with both hands, sometimes ruthlessly, and they were the first to assemble the puzzle correctly. In the wake of their discovery, a new science, molecular biology, sprang up. In faraway Melbourne, I learned with increasing excitement that the genetic code had been cracked and that DNA is copied into RNA molecules for translation into proteins, the workhorse molecules of our cells. And so came the day that as a 23-year-old graduate student, I made the watershed decision of my life. I wrote to Francis Crick to ask if I could do my PhD with him. I hardly dared hope for a reply, so I was shocked and very excited when he actually said yes. And I still don't know why. Perhaps simply because it was so unusual at the time to have a request from so far away. Cambridge was an unforgettable experience. The Laboratory of Molecular Biology, affectionately known as the LMB, was an amazing place, still is. When I arrived in 1966, five of the six founding fathers were still there, and four had already won Nobel Prizes. The one who influenced me the most was Fred Sanger, a gentle and modest man whose impact on the life sciences has been incalculable. Fred was never happier than when he was working with his own hands at the lab bench. He'd won the Nobel Prize in 1958 for being the first to work out the order or sequence of amino acids in a protein. Now he was working out ways of sequencing RNA molecules, and what I learned in his laboratory launched my own career. Sanger later moved on to the ultimate challenge, sequencing DNA, succeeding brilliantly and gaining his second Nobel Prize in 1980. Only three other scientists have ever been awarded two Nobel Prizes. Fred had a great affection for Australia, and many Australians trained with him. Sadly, he passed away in November last year. A great loss to the world. Sanger's DNA sequencing method laid the foundation for the Human Genome Project, biology's equivalent of the Apollo Project. This began in 1990, funded by governments and philanthropy. The heady goal was to determine the order of the 3 billion or so chemical base pairs that make up human DNA, in order to identify all our genes. By 2003, the first blueprint had been assembled, just in time for the 50th anniversary of the DNA helix. The first human genome sequence took 13 years and cost about $3 billion. But the technology has advanced so much that you can now get your genome sequenced in a week, and it soon will only cost you $1,000. We now know the genomes not only of humans, but also of many animals, plants, and microbes. And the information is continually updated and publicly available in huge computer databases around the world. These digital gene banks represent one of humankind's greatest treasures. Through them, we shall be able to trace our evolution from the simplest organism. Through them, we shall understand in ever-increasing detail how our bodies function in health and how diseases develop. Through them, we have entered the age of precision medicine. I'd like to use my own field, cancer, to give you a feel for precision medicine, but the principles apply to every area of medicine. Of course, cancer is one of humankind's most dreaded foes. It's so feared that some people struggle even to say the word out loud. Put more simply, cancer is uncontrolled growth of cells. It's too many cells growing where they shouldn't be growing. A cancer starts as a single cell that accidentally acquires a mutation that allows it to multiply more vigorously than its neighbors. And over time, the sons and daughters of that cell acquire other mutations and multiply even faster. And eventually, the mass of fully fledged tumor cells invade and obstruct vital organs in the body, leading to death. Today, it's very well established that cancer is a malady of our genes, and that it's not just one disease, but hundreds. But when I first entered this field with my scientific partner and husband, Gerry Adams, little was known about the molecular causes of cancer. The first major clue had emerged in 1976 with a riveting and later Nobel Prize-winning discovery in San Francisco by Harold Varmus and Mike Bishop. They found that the cancer-provoking gene in a chicken retrovirus closely resembled a gene found in healthy cells. The stunning implication of this was that the virus had hijacked a normal gene and transformed it into a deadly weapon. This discovery kicked off a gold rush in the 80s, fueled by the new gene cloning technology, and Gerry and I eagerly enlisted, switching from immunology to cancer research. Astonishingly, human tumours proved to harbour many of the same culprit genes as animal retroviruses. Some had been mutated by external agents, others simply through errors made in the normal gene copying process. Gerry and I focused on an abnormal chromosome found in most human Burkitt lymphomas, and we found that DNA cutting and pasting had activated a gene called MYC. This seemed highly likely to be the cause of the disease, but at this stage, it was only guilt by association. We went on with US colleagues to engineer mice to test the hypothesis. And I will never forget how excited we were when that phone call came from the US telling us that the mice with the altered MYC gene were coming down with lymphomas, every single one of them. The root cause of Burkitt's lymphoma was now beyond dispute. It's now known that each of our cells has a repertoire of several hundred latent cancer-causing genes. These genes, which we call oncogenes, are not designed to cause cancer, but they can do so if they're liberated from normally strict controls or mutated into a more active form. Close in the wake of the oncogene wave came the discovery of an entirely new class of cancer-promoting mutations, this time involving inactivation of genes that normally suppress tumour development. With this growing roll call of potential villains, it began to seem that humans were walking cancer time bombs. How did most of us survive for decades without getting cancer? Well, the answer is that one oncogenic mutation is not sufficient to make a normal cell fully malignant. Instead, multiple genetic alterations are required. These were very heady times in the field. We were uncovering the dark secrets of cancer and starting to work out the underlying principles. We even dared to dream of new drugs which targeted specific cancer mutations. This dream first became reality in the 90s, and it transformed the lives of patients with CML, or chronic myeloid leukemia. In CML cells, an abnormal chromosome encodes a novel hybrid gene that produces a supercharged enzyme. With this discovery, which took years, the key to fighting CML became clear. Find an inhibitor for this CML-specific enzyme, and you might be able to stop the cancer growing. British chemist Nicholas Lydon and clinician Brian Druker from Oregon University eventually succeeded in doing just this, and their drug, Gleevec, was amazingly effective. In its first clinical trial in 1998, 95% of patients achieved a complete response, and the side effects were minimal, unlike with most chemotherapy. The US FDA was so impressed that it accelerated registration of this drug to only 23 months, which is probably still a record. Gleevec was the first precision cancer drug, and it is still the poster child for this approach. Fast forwarding to 2014, many more such drugs have been developed. Some are chemicals, like Gleevec. Others are antibodies, like Herceptin, which prolonged my own mother's life when she developed breast cancer. Each precision cancer drug represents decades of work by hundreds of scientists and clinicians in both academia and industry, and the total dollar cost is huge. But much more remains to be done. There are still no magic bullets for many types of cancer, such as pancreatic cancer or brain gliomas. Cancer researchers want to change that. To speed up the discovery process, international consortia, which include Australian scientists, are collecting many different sorts of tumours from hundreds of people and sequencing their DNA. These massive cancer genome projects, as we call them, hope to find patterns amongst the genetic changes that will show doctors how best to treat individual cancer types. Let me give you a glimpse of this through the eyes of Ilana Simon, whom I heard speak earlier this year at a conference. Ilana is now a very lively and beautiful 18-year-old. But when she was 12, she was diagnosed with a very rare type of liver cancer. Ilana was lucky. She received surgery and she's still in full remission. But Ilana did not leave it there. Through a program at her high school in Manhattan, she had learned how to apply her computer skills to mining DNA data. And she decided to do this for her own cancer. She used her persuasive social media skills to reach out to other young patients and with the help of her surgeon, assembled 15 different samples of this liver cancer. Then she raised funding to have their DNA sequenced and compared the sequences. To her amazement, she noticed that each of the tumour samples had one particular genetic change in common. Currently, surgery is the only treatment available for Ilana's type of liver cancer, but she's identified a target for a new drug, a remarkable achievement for a high school student. Despite our small population, Australians are world players in medical research. 7 of our 15 Nobel Prize winners have been medical researchers. I've already mentioned Howard Florey, and I'm sure you've all heard of our Nobel immunologists, McFarlane Burnett and Peter Doherty. Then there's neurophysiologist John Eccles. And the West Australian duo, Barry Marshall and Robin Warren, who found that gastric ulcers are caused by infection with Helicobacter pylori rather than by stress. And of course, Elizabeth Blackburn, who discovered telomeres, the vital protective cap of our chromosomes. But scores of other Australian medical scientists have also transformed knowledge and lives. Let me remind you of just a few. Think of immunologists, Jacques Miller, who discovered that the thymus is absolutely vital for immunity rather than just a vestigial organ. And Don Metcalf, whose hormones for white blood cell production have helped over 20 million cancer patients, including tenor Jose Carreras, who credits Don with saving his life. Fiona Wood, whose spray-on skin has saved many burns patients, including victims of the terrible Bali bombings. And then there's Graham Clark, whose bionic ear has brought hearing to more than 250,000 people worldwide. And Ian Fraser, whose papillomavirus vaccine, Gardasil, will save millions of women around the world from developing cervical cancer. Australia also has many great public health researchers, like the other great Fiona from Western Australia, Fiona Stanley, who works tirelessly to improve health outcomes for Australia's Indigenous people. And Ian Gust, who developed diagnostic tools for minimising HIV transmission through our blood banks. And of course, Gus Nossal, tireless global warrior for vaccination. You should understand, however, that Australia's strength in biomedicine is no accident. Starting with the founding of the National Health and Medical Research Council in 1937, it's a result of sustained scientific and political leadership and unwavering commitment to excellence. Strong support from the philanthropic sector has also been crucial. The stories I've told you of our biomedical stars tell us that it usually takes decades before a lab discovery reaches the clinic and often requires quite extraordinary dedication. They also demonstrate how important it is to nurture our young researchers. Many of the scientists I mentioned made their greatest discoveries quite early in their careers. Most trained overseas, and that should continue. Our young people must be exposed to the brightest and the best wherever they are in the world. But we mustn't lose too many of them permanently. We should actively recruit them back. I'd like all our future Nobel Prizes to be won by researchers working here in Australia rather than overseas. Given the recent government vision to inject huge new funding into biomedical research, it's important to underline here that medical research is not done in isolation. It stands on the shoulders of many disciplines, including physics, chemistry, mathematics, engineering, and as you've heard, information technology. Frontier science is increasingly convergent science. If Australia hopes to keep producing world-changing medical research, we must sustain investment in all the sciences. Australia's strength in biomedicine has become an important economic driver for the nation. It may surprise you to know that the medicinal and pharmaceutical products industry is now Australia's largest manufacturing export sector. Cochlear, CSL, and ResMed are the best known, but there are over 1,000 biotech companies in Australia, and more than 100 of these are listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. The sector's growing at 17% per annum, and it's now worth about $33 billion to the Australian economy. We must foster the further growth of this sector and support fledgling companies with taxation benefits. We also need to redress our shortage of management and entrepreneurial skills. Let's court the many experienced Australians working in biotech companies overseas and encourage them back here. I'm sure you will agree from this helicopter view that the last century has seen truly mind-blowing advances in biomedicine and health, and that Australia has played a significant role. As we look into the future, through the eyeglass of stringent fiscal restraint, we can't rest on our laurels. We cannot assume continued improvement. We must remain vigilant and persuasive. As renowned health advocate Mary Lasker famously said to the US Congress, "If you think research is expensive, try disease." The health of our society remains vitally dependent on having well-trained and innovative medical and public health researchers. These are also the people who will keep healthcare affordable and accessible. So to ensure that our children and our grandchildren live long, healthy and productive lives, we must ensure that Australia steadily increases its investment, but not only in biomedical research, in all the sciences. Thank you for your attention.
Professor Suzanne Corey with her first Boyer Lecture, Science for a Healthy People. Next time, she shows how much science and technology underpins a strong modern economy. Professor Corey is a former president of the Australian Academy of Science, now celebrating its 60th year. You can, of course, hear these lectures again by going to the RN website and selecting Boyer Lectures. I'm Robin Williams.